Hello, welcome to Literally from the North Shore, and thanks for tuning in. Today we are listening to Sins of Our Fathers, a novel by Sean Lawrence Otto, published in 2014 by Milkweed Editions.
In the hall, Eagle watched Jacob rubbing his eye with the heel of his hand. Jacob took the knife back from Eagle's weakened hand, and Eagle let him go. He watched him head down the hall into his room and close the door, and not long after he heard the muted sounds of Call of Duty 4, Modern Warfare. His son was losing himself in bullets and fire. He stood still in the hall's emptiness, listening to the house, then went into his study and closed the door. He sighed and leaned back against it. Things seemed to be getting worse, but he told himself that he needed to be patient. Yes, Jacob had crummy friends and bad grades and even trouble with the law, but it was also true that the police were racist. Jacob had a good heart. He attracted troubled boys because he accepted them, and acting out was part of the grieving process. But he also knew that it didn't have to be this way. He just couldn't seem to find a way to change the dynamic. No matter what he tried, it felt as if they were trapped in this place, in the aftermath of Winona's death, pulled farther and farther apart by their diverging galaxies. The apple comment was particularly concerning. Red on the outside, white on the inside. Not Indian enough meant not poor or dysfunctional enough for res life, a sort of reverse racism. It made Eagle angry. It wasn't fair to dump 500 years of history on a boy. He knew he wasn't the most involved father. When Jacob was younger, he had reached out to Eagle plenty of times. "Hey, Dad, let's do this." And Eagle hadn't made the time. He always had good reasons. There was a meeting at work he had to prepare for, or a tough day he had to recover from. He would have liked to do more. He always intended to the next time Jacob asked. But the job was demanding, especially for an Indian. He was breaking barriers. It took extra energy. And banking was hyper-competitive to begin with. His co-workers didn't seem to be spending more time with their kids either, and they seemed to be just fine. Winona was the one who'd wanted kids anyway. And then the bottom dropped out. After she died, Eagle realized to his surprise that living in South Minneapolis wasn't the same for Jacob as it had been when he was growing up. Jacob wasn't getting fed at friends' houses, and the friends Jacob made weren't the articulate kids of academics and professionals that Eagle had hung out with in his youth. There seemed to be more gangs, drugs, and violence. Jacob had two bikes stolen, one of them at gunpoint, and the kids he hung around with looked tougher and tougher. It all came to a head one day in late September. Eagle had been working at the bank downtown. After a power lunch with a bunch of executives, he had put together a $500 million corporate financing package for General Mills. He came home around 8 to learn that Jacob had been arrested with a friend for stealing tobacco from Lowell's drugstore. "You should bring him home," his mother said over the phone. Eagle had banished Jacob to his room after a big fight and then gone for a walk to cool down. He was sitting on a city bench near the rippling black water of Minnehaha Creek. Brown bats dropped from the eaves of houses, unfolded their wings, and cluttered the air. Frogs pulsed in the long grasses by the riverbank. It was 2 hours earlier in Los Angeles, where his parents had transferred when Jacob was 5. His mom was stuck in traffic on the 405. He could hear the engines. "At least it's tobacco," she said. "The spirits might be trying to guide him." He pressed his cell tight to his ear and looked out at the stone and Tudor houses on the other side of the glistening creek. Someone was having a party. He could hear the clink of glasses and laughter, the playing of a piano, and the closing of a car door. He saw a couple in evening dress walking up the sidewalk, arm in arm. He realized that part of him was secretly hoping his mother would tell him to ship the boy off to live with them in Los Angeles.
"What do you mean, bring him home?"
he asked. "To the reservation. That boy needs to get back in touch with the land," she said, "with his roots and the people, not all this wannabe gangbanger That's a recipe for being downtrodden forever. I see the same thing here in L.A. Listen to me, baby. You gotta press reset." As a 60s-era native rights activist and a college professor, his mom believed the land and the elders could heal Jacob, as if by osmosis. Eagle shared his white father's more skeptical views and thought her idealism naive. To him, the reservation was a place of dysfunction and squalor, not a source of spiritual rebirth. He doubted it would change anything for Jacob. The reality was that her son just wasn't cut out to be a father. He never had been. He sat picking at the softening wood slats of the bench as she countered, "Winona was so good at being a mom that you didn't have to build any skill. But now you have to." "You make it sound so simple." "It's not. It takes work." "But if your father did it in his I'm a scientist, not a dad, Gichi Mukamanwe. You sure as can." Eagle laughed.
"He actually said that?"
"Yeah, he said that. But I think he did an okay job with you." Eagle sighed. He had seen the arc of his life extending forward like a shining arrow. With his gift and his ambition, he would rise to the top. As an Indian? No. As Johnny Eagle, a guy with a funny-sounding last name, who had the goods to get things done, to make progress. That was also how he was going to provide for his family and for his son. He had a new membership at the Minneapolis Athletic Club, and with it, access to the city's financial elite. The sky was the limit. And now he was contemplating giving it all up, just when the brass ring was within reach. "He's your child," she said.
"I know, I know. But you're talking a career here. And I can't guarantee him anything if I leave banking."
He knew how hard it would be to get back in, and that if he left, he probably never would. It was through Winona, rather than his mother, that he had come to know the reservation. How ironic it was that he met her in Minneapolis. She took it upon herself to educate him about his land, his people, their history, all the things he had never wanted to hear about from his mother. And through her eyes they had always seemed mysterious and cosmic. But there were plenty of hungry young bankers nipping at his heels. Faltering for even a second was risky, much less walking away for years. He hung his head and rubbed his forehead. 4 years on the res, 14 to 18. Then you can send him away to the former instrument of cultural genocide, and you'll be off the hook, she said. It was her term for the University of Minnesota, Morris. He'll be surrounded by good kids, and he'll get past this. The campus had once been an Indian boarding school where children were sent, often against their parents' will, to learn white ways and Christian religion, breaking the intergenerational chain of stories and language that had held tribes together. When the repurposed school became part of the university, it was on the condition that any native kid who qualified could attend tuition-free. Eagle pinched the bridge of his nose and sighed. 4 years. If he could get him there. He realized he had made his decision. He was just hoping she would give him a last-minute reprieve. And now here they were, on the res, and Jacob was having the same problems. Eagle had given it all up, apparently for nothing. In desperation, he'd bought Jacob the horse. He'd even moved next door to Winona's sister, though an argument over her incessant drinking had ended any hopes he had of it being a constructive relationship. What more could he do? At some point, Jacob would have to start meeting him halfway. But watching him earlier in the day with the horse, seeing how excited and childlike he was, had moved Eagle almost to tears. Maybe he could steer J.W. toward helping Jacob more. Back in his trailer, J.W. reached up to turn off the receiver. There hadn't been much sound for a while, but as he extended his hand toward the switch, he heard a strange series of clicks, followed by the squeak of a hinge. then the crinkling of a plastic bag, and a moment later the flick of a lighter and a soft sizzle, followed by a pause, then a windy exhale. It sounded as if Eagle was smoking a pipe, a pot pipe. J.W. listened in the moonlight. The table still swam with the shadows of leaves, and the music still boomed down from the neighbor's delirious party. But it was all different now. He had a grip on something that could be the answer for him. He went to the kitchen junk drawer and pawed around until he found a small digital recorder. He held an earbud to it and pressed record. There it was again. The faint, sizzling inhale followed by a slight pause and a blowing exhale. J.W. turned the receiver off. He thumbed the tiny volume dial to max and pressed rewind and then play to hear it again. Sizzling inhale, blowing exhale. He pressed stop. His eyes fell to the small spiral notepad. He underlined "smokes pot" with two sharp strokes. The Treasury Department would frown on giving a banking charter to someone who smoked pot. The fiduciary and political liabilities were simply too great. With Jesus and Lady Luck on his side, J.W. realized, he just may have found a way to stop Eagle and get his job back. Part 3. The Wagers. Chapter 14. J.W. tried calling Carol on the greasy antique payphone outside Big Al's garage. "You've reached the White House. Leave a message." He hung up, frustrated. Inside, they hadn't even looked at his car.
"I figured you weren't coming back for her," Big Al said. This from a man, J.W. thought, who was always late on his loan payments.
"Why would you think that?" he asked.
Big Al shrugged. J.W. stood in the garage's storefront, dressed in his finest gray suit and a crisp white shirt. Cream-colored metal shelves, smudged with swipes of black grease, held Interstate car batteries, and stacks of Michelin tires covered the bare concrete floor, topped with cardboard cutouts of a tire man. A foggy-globed gumball machine stood by the door, full of faintly visible colored orbs. A smudged olive-green cash register sat on the glass counter, and the air was pregnant with the smells of body odor and motor oil.
"What you driving, anyway?"
asked Big Al, peering out the window at the truck Eagle had lent him. It was hand-painted with a round, native-looking logo and lettering along the bed that read, "Native Organic Wild Rice."
"It belongs to a friend," J.W. began, then raised a hand to revise his answer.
"An acquaintance. I rented it." Big Al raised an eyebrow. He turned away to grab a shop towel for his greasy hands.
"Let's take a look up under her skirt."
He walked around the counter and shoved the glass door open. A string of brass bells smashed and swayed against it as he passed. Outside, he led J.W. through a gate and a chain-link fence that ran around a weedy gravel yard east of the shop. It was filled with old junkers that Big Al used for spare parts. The Caprice sat amid some weeds near the street. Big Al walked up to it, spread a dirty hand on the hood, and lowered his bulk to the ground.
"They ever catch the drunk Indian that run you down?"
"They were just kids." Big Al grunted and stuck his head under the car.
"Well, those drunk Indian kids cost you about $1,200, $1,500. Hub shot, axles bent. Maybe I can straighten it, but it's probably not worth it. Steering, tie rod maybe, boots. Who's your insurance?"
J.W. had dropped his collision and comprehensive coverage a few months back when he was in the thick of the cloud. He hadn't had an accident in 15 years, and at the time he thought he could leverage the savings into winnings that would pay the premiums for a whole year. He would double that, then repurchase them and add the rest to his nut. Looking back now, it seemed crazy. Big Al poked his head out from beneath the car to see if J.W. had heard him.
"I only have liability," he said. The mechanic got to his feet, brushing his hands off on his soiled blue coveralls.
Seriously? You got no insurance. The guy that makes me carry it on every goddamn thing just to keep my loan.
He laughed bitterly, then led J.W. back toward the shop. The door chimes banged around J.W.'s head as they crossed back inside. A fat kid in a blue jumpsuit was rotating tires with an impact wrench, filling the building with harsh, metallic chatter.
"Well, J.W., what you gonna do?" Big Al yelled over the noise. "I said $1,500 to be good to you since we go back to high school, but when I get into it, it could be more. And that doesn't include the airbag. You want that done, that's another grand."
"It is what it is," J.W. said. "Go ahead, accept the airbag."
Big Al nodded tentatively.
"Okay," he said. "I'll need cash up front."
J.W. looked at him. He realized he was clenching his jaw and let it loosen before speaking.
"I pushed through the loan so you could buy this place," he said, just loud enough to be heard over the noise. "You didn't have the credit."
"And I appreciate that, but now I gotta pay on that loan, so I gotta have cash. I'm sure you understand."
He nodded as he spoke, but his gaze was firm. J.W. nodded, visibly angry.
"It'll be a couple days then. Payment schedules," he said over the noise.
Big Al nodded in return.
"I understand. I'll leave her sitting there for another week or so."
"A week?
Two. Whatever, but I can't have it here forever. You know that."
J.W. nodded, then walked out without saying a word. The sun was hot. He got into the pickup and slammed the door, rattling the change that had reappeared in the handle. As he turned the ignition, he became acutely aware of the feathers, the beads, and the dream catcher hanging from the rearview mirror. There was a cassette tape of Eric Clapton's Unplugged stuck in the player, and it played over and over. He punched it off. As he backed out, he saw Big Al take in the truck's tribal license plate, then shake his head as he turned back to the car bays. He thought about Big Al's expression as he drove back to the res. The entire exchange had left him feeling as if he had somehow slipped into an alternate reality in which people like Al Bakken felt entitled to judge him, not because of his troubles, but because he was living on the reservation. He had somehow become one of them, and there was now more to prove, more doubts to overcome. He thought he had sensed the same sort of attitude from others that morning, at the gas station and waiting at a stoplight. No one was any less polite, but there was a coolness. Or was it all in his mind? He turned onto the lane that ran through the trees and then onto the barn drive that led up to Eagle's rice operation, more determined than ever to find the evidence he needed to stop him and his bank. Then he'd see about Big Al and his late loan payments. As he pulled in by the pole barn, Eagle walked out of the big door and pulled it closed.
"Where the hell have you been?" he said. "I've been waiting for you. Get in the Bronco."
Waterfowl Lake was perhaps the most aptly named lake in Minnesota. As Eagle pulled into the long grass under some trees near the shore, J.W. could see thousands of birds, landing and taking off, calling and arguing and eating. The lake covered some 150 acres, and the entire surface was green and tan with the wheat-like stalks of wild rice. J.W. stepped out of the Bronco and looked around, dumbfounded.
"More than 1 million waterfowl come through this lake during the fall migration," Eagle told him.
The birds funneled down from vast stretches of Ontario, Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Alberta, even the Northwest Territories. The air was thick with black ducks, wood ducks, gadwalls, pintails, scops, ringnecks, canvasbacks, redheads, mallards, mergansers, and ruddies, as well as the massive honking traffic jams of incoming Canada geese and their great white brethren, trumpeter swans. All colors and varieties of waterfowl floated and squabbled amid the rice, quacking and carping and splashing. Groups of band members stood on the shore near canoes beached in the long grass. A group was gathered around Hal Charm, a blonde man of about 45 who wore a floppy cloth cowboy hat and a green netted vest.
"Hal's our biologist," Eagle told JW as they approached the group. "He's managed to double the rice harvest in the last 3 years."
As they neared the group, JW saw one of the Indians glance over at them in a way that was not welcoming.
"Apple's got a white boy with him," he heard.
"Hal, how's it looking?" Eagle asked as they entered the group. "Well, as I was telling Black Bear here, conditions look good to me, and you can tell they look good to the ducks, too. The Rice Committee approved the opener for today, but we're still waiting for final word from the elders on whether it's really ready to harvest."
Just then, an elder stood up in a canoe out amid the rice stalks. He raised his two rice-knocking sticks high in the air to signal the rice opener.
"And that's it," added Hal.
The gathered groups of men, women, and children whooped with excitement. They broke up quickly and headed happily for their canoes. Eagle led JW back to the Bronco and popped the ratchet straps holding the Kevlar canoe, a Winona, to the racks on top.
"Come on, let's go."
Eagle hoisted the canoe onto his shoulders, where it easily balanced, propped up by two blue foam blocks attached to an ash yoke spanning its middle.
"Grab the knockers and the life jackets," he said.
He pulled a long wooden pole off the car rack and headed for the lake. JW looked around the back of the vehicle and found the vests and two three-foot-long, drumstick-like pieces of wood. They were surprisingly light. He grabbed them and followed Eagle, who already had the canoe in the water and was standing ankle-deep.
"Okay, get in."
JW walked to the stern end and began to step in.
"Hey, hold it!"
He stopped and looked back at Eagle.
"I'm not going to let you bridge my boat. Just walk out next to it and climb in. Drain your shoes over the edge before you put your feet in."
JW looked at him.
"I'm serious. They'll dry. What, you never been canoeing?"
"Fine." JW waded out over the sandy bottom in his shoes and pants and climbed in, doing his best not to drag too much water in with him. As soon as he was settled, Eagle pushed off with the pole and they glided out into the long grasses.
"What do I do?"
asked JW.
"What they're doing."
JW took the knockers from his lap and looked around. The Indians were expertly guiding their canoes through the rice plants, each one pulled by a man standing in the stern. Those in the bows used one knocker to gently bend the rice stalks over the other and then brushed or shook the rice kernels off into the canoe. Several of them were making fast work of it, seemingly racing. Rice stalks glided past on either side of the translucent yellow bow. They looked like long stalks of wheat that stood about 3 feet above the surface of the water. JW tried bending a few with the sticks, but at first he pushed too hard and creased the stems. The heavy stalks folded over, became waterlogged, and started to sink to the bottom. The Indians he saw around them were incredibly fast, but they were bending the stalks more gently over the canoe with one knocker and rubbing the other knocker over the top of them, or lightly beating the grass. JW tried again, and this time he got a large shower of kernels to fall off into his lap. The rice was encased in purple-green, wheat-like coverings and was full of insects, rice worms, and spiders. He brushed some off his lap.
"Don't worry about that," Eagle said. "They won't bite you too much."
"Easy for you to say."
"Come on, get your together, white boy. They're putting us to shame. This is what I'm paying you for."
JW kept at it. As the canoe began moving forward at a more rapid pace, he developed a swiping motion, swaying the sticks rhythmically side to side and smoothly knocking stickful after stickful of rice onto his lap from both sides of the canoe.
"Now you're getting it."
Soon his feet were sprinkled with rice and his pants were crawling with daddy longlegs and wolf spiders. He continued, sweating, as Eagle sought out the richest patches of rice and then methodically poled the canoe back and forth through them. JW found the work straining but satisfying as the level of kernels steadily grew, first halfway up his shoes, then over and into them, and then up his ankles. The sky was mostly clear and the carping of waterfowl filled the air. When he disturbed a merganser hiding in the rice, The sudden rush of wings made him laugh out loud. After another hour, the sky gave way to a deep crystal blue and the enriching light of September. The leaves on the trees were just beginning to turn. The ripening rice plants filled the air with a strong grassy smell, and they brushed alongside the canoe with the dry hiss of hay packing into a baler. The two men settled into an easy rhythm. "Why do they call you Apple?" J.W. asked. He pulled a daddy long legs off his neck and threw it out onto the grasses.
"Trying to get to me," Eagle replied nonchalantly. "See those guys? We're going to show them up."
J.W. looked over in the direction he had indicated. Two canoes were working in tandem. In the bow of one was the Indian who had made the remark about Eagle.
"I'm in," he said.
Eagle picked up the pace and J.W. began to swipe and knock faster and faster. A wordless competition sprang up across the lake. Soon several canoes seemed to be moving faster, matching pace with Eagle and J.W., as the veteran ricers worked to put the upstart and his outsider sidekick in their place. The sun set around 6:30, and the air began to run cool down the hillsides onto the lake. Band members finally turned their heavily laden canoes for shore. J.W. set his knockers down in relief and rolled his burning shoulders. He had constantly pushed the rice kernels backward in order to keep the canoe from getting bow-heavy. Eagle stood shin-deep, while J.W. was buried up to his seated thighs. The rice smelled like a rich meadow. J.W. ran his tired fingers through it as the shining waters glided by. Eagle pulled them, bow first, up onto the muddy sandbank.
"Day of reckoning," he said. "Hop on out."
J.W. stood and purple-green kernels rained down off his jeans. He shook his legs off over the canoe one by one, still feeling many more kernels inside his shoes, then stepped out into the cool water. He stood beside the heavy canoe and pulled the bow a few more inches up onto the muddy shore.
"That's good enough,"
said Eagle, bracing himself before he stepped out into the knee-deep water at the stern. Both men looked around at the returning canoes. None were as low in the water as theirs.
"Don't quote me on it, but I think we beat 'em," Eagle said.
J.W. knew enough about Indians to know that this kind of competitive thinking ran counter to the spirit some elders approached the rice harvest with, but Eagle seemed anxious to show them all up. J.W., tired of being judged, was also tickled by the thought. Several Indians walked past their canoe, heading to their cars to get plastic snow shovels and lawn and leaf bags. J.W. watched them expectantly, noting how each of them glanced into the canoe as they passed. They ignored J.W., but one by one they glanced at Eagle and nodded. The man who had made the slur walked by without even looking. Eagle glanced at J.W. with a grin.
"I think that makes it official," he said. "Come on, let's get the bags and pack up our haul."
You have been listening to Episode 10 of Sins of Our Fathers by Sean Lawrence Otto. The novel will be presented in a total of 23 episodes. If you miss any, you can catch up on our website, ktwh.org. Choose Programs and then Literally from the North Shore from the drop-down list. Please join us again next time for Episode 11 of Sins of Our Fathers, here on Literally from the North Shore.